Welcome to the 11KBW podcast on data protection, dealing with the nuts and bolts by Robin Hopkins. This talk was given at the 11KBW Information Law Conference on the 19th of March 2015. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kbw.com.
Morning, everyone. I will start with a confession, or a melancholy observation, insight about data protection. And this is an insight I've built up over years of talking zealously and in slightly crazed fashion to non-lawyers about data protection, as I do all of the time at family events at Christmas, to other guests at weddings, other parents at children's parties, that sort of thing. The insight is this, that not everyone finds every single aspect of the Data Protection Act 1998 gripping, sexy, and glamorous. Okay, say some of these heretics as I jabber on. I've read about some of this stuff, Snowden and what the security services do with all of our personal data online, act like Chowdhury kind of thing. That stuff, I see that as reasonably sexy. Google Spain, right to be forgotten, intrusion into media space, Max Mosley and what he gets up to. I see that that sort of thing is sexy, though that depends on what you consider sexy, I suppose. More from that sort of thing from Anya this afternoon. But all this stuff that sits in the middle, the heart of this regime, what is personal data, who are data controllers, what are the data protection principles, what are enforcement powers, and so on, that stuff is pretty unreadable. So pity then the speaker who steps up to address you on that exact slot, what I've called the nuts and bolts of the Data Protection Act regime. There is, of course, the option, tempting to someone in my position, to try and jazz this up a bit in a pretty cheap way. For example, you could do lots of Google image searches, paste them into your presentation, make jokes about Kardashians and pop stars and whoever these people are, that sort of thing, and get a few cheap gags. That is one route, taken by our part information law speaker, part children's party jester, Christopher Knight. And could I just say on behalf of Chambers, I'm really sorry about that patronizing approach to a very serious topic. Chris, I'm sure, will be spoken to before next year. Indeed, there are feedback forms and even complaints to the Bar Council that you could consider about that. But anyway, that's not the route I'm going to take, too patronizing. Actually, I should confess that I did think about that. And if you do Google image searches for data protection, the images are unspeakably boring. They make this stuff, they make the wording of the act look fascinating. So what you have to do, I'm digressing a bit, but what you have to do is add after the words data protection something else, like data protection lawyer. That actually brings up pictures of some of the people in this room. Imagine how envious I am at that. And then if you add other things, you know, Data Protection Act, Max Mosley, then you start running into other sorts of problems. But ACLAC has stolen the one gag that I had about judges and porn. Never mind. So, Data Protection Act and nuts and bolts as my topic. And the way I've approached that is the way that it seems to me some clients, be they internal or external, often want to discuss the Data Protection Act issues with their lawyers. There are some who are just not very familiar with or very up to date on the extent of their Data Protection Act responsibilities. They might, and in my experience often do, have quite fundamental questions that take roughly this short sort of shape. Where does the right arise? What does it bite on, these Data Protection Act rights that people have? What's the unit that really triggers the obligations? Answer, well, it bites on personal data. It's about personal data. So we'll have a look at updates on that in one section of our framework. Next question that is often asked, well, who do these obligations apply to? Answer, data controller, the person who determines the manner and purposes of processing. Next question that often arises is, okay, what is the shape of the duties that are imposed upon me as a data controller? And the last question that always lurks is, What if I breach those duties? What happens to me? So that's the kind of framework that I'm going to be using today to update us on developments recent and forthcoming on the nuts and bolts of the Data Protection Act. So let's start with the first of those issues, and that is the unit that the Data Protection Act bites upon, personal data. Now, two broad limbs to that definition that most of you who work in this area will know backwards. First limb, the information must relate to a living individual. So there's the relation limb. And second, that living individual must be identifiable in some fairly convoluted way from the information that you're looking at. So there's an identification limb as well. The relates to limb, that is governed now by two Court of Appeal decisions that sit something awkwardly alongside each other. And those are the decisions in EDIM, the longer standing decision in Durham, and the newer decision from a year or so ago in EDIM. In a nutshell, Durant creates a restrictive impression of what counts as personal data. In borderline cases, said the Court of Appeal in a nutshell, it's relevant for you to think about whether the information you're considering has the individual among its focuses, as opposed to they're playing some sort of bit part. Is it biographically significant about them in a way that has a bearing on their privacy? If the answers to those questions in your borderline cases is no, you as a data controller, if that's your perspective, entitled to say that falls outside Data Protection Act rights. EDIM, on the other hand, cuts through that in a factual context that was odd, looking at just the question, is a name personal data? EDIM cuts through that and says, well, never mind Durant's, in cases where the information is obviously about an individual, and that's the key phrase, is it obviously about an individual? If so, never mind Durant, it's going to relate to them. They do, in the minds of some, sit awkwardly together, not because they're inconsistent, but because they create a headache in practice. For example, if you're tasked with doing a subject access search through years' worth of email inboxes, in the old days, some took the approach, well, Durant meant I could be quite restrictive about what I would bring within that net. EDIM now seems to bring within the potentially disclosable net a vast array of information. So there are practical difficulties about actually applying, when responding to things like subject access requests, these two judgments. They depend on the facts you're trying to apply them to. Your clients, internal or external, will often need help reconciling these two and arriving at a justifiable approach to the scope of personal data. Clients will also often say, okay, I see these two cases. They're reasonably extreme. Mr. Durant was a man who wanted vast reams of information that had been spun out of, generated by a complaint that he'd initiated. Mr. EDIM, on the other hand, for his own curious reasons, only wanted the disclosure of a name. Most of the time, people are not on either end of those, on either of those poles. They are somewhere in the middle. Are there any case studies? Are there any cases that shed light on some sort of middle territory? Clients often ask. Frustratingly, answer is, well, not really, not very many. But here is one. It's a decision from the European Court summer of last year, the YS and Minister for Immigrati case. And that was about an individual who had applied for a residence permit or an extension of a residence permit in the Netherlands. His information was then processed, subject to an assessment of his situation to answer the question, does he get his permit or not? Problems arise with that, and he asks for the disclosure to him of his personal data. The key document is called a minute in this case, and it's got various tiers of information. It contains the some procedural stuff that didn't really matter. It contained the employees who were working on the case, some of their personal data, never mind that either. It contains the obviously personal data section to the applicant, his date of birth, personal details, family situation. So a piece of narrative that is squarely about the applicant. Fine, no problem there. That is clearly personal data. but then it contains a piece of analysis, which was referred to in that case as legal analysis. And what that was about was taking the individual's circumstances in the obviously personal data category, thinking about analysing them, and then arriving at a view, an assessment of how the law or immigration policy applied to that particular individual's situation, to tell them yes or no, do they succeed or not in their application. What about this piece of reasoning, this legal analysis? Is that personal data or not? Answer given by the European Court, no, not personal data on the facts of that case. And they say that really what the legal analysis section is an assessment and application of law and policy to an individual's situation, even though it is springboarding off an individual's personal circumstances. The analysis is not itself their personal data. It's an exercise in legal or policy thinking. And in doing that, in giving that answer, the court took what is clearly a purposive approach. That is, they're thinking about personal data, at least in part, in this way. If something is at the margins, the court asks itself, would it have any bearing on this person's personal privacy rights? Would the legal analysis section have a bearing on their personal privacy rights? Would they be able to advance their privacy rights by, for example, checking the accuracy in that section of the document, the legal analysis section? Would it assist them in that way? Those are the sorts of purposes behind the DPA, and those are not the sorts of purposes that this legal analysis section would have helped with, said the court. So that is one case that gives a bit of insight, and it's something that might help to flesh out and illustrate for clients in discussions as to what personal data means. Second limb I mentioned, what is personal data? Second limb is the identification limb. The individual must be reasonably likely to be identified from either that information on its own, the information you're thinking about, or that information plus something else. Now, that something else is quite an open-ended piece of thinking for you and your clients to do. You need to think about not only what other information is currently already out there in the public domain or available to others that could help piece together this identification puzzle, but what sort of information could reasonably be obtained by someone who decided that they wanted to go down this sleuthing path to identify the person who you are trying to anonymise. It's what the Information Commissioner in his anonymisation code of practice calls the motivated intruder test, and you're asking yourself exactly those sorts of questions. If someone wanted to do this, to take this document I've anonymised and piece together who it's referring to, how could they go about doing that? What information might they get their hands on? And what could they reasonably do to put that picture together? And that's the approach to follow. The only case I mentioned by way of update on this slide is one Chris mentioned this morning, the Ferrand case, an FOI case in the upper tribunal. That raised this point in the context of identification and personal data. Requester says something like this: I've asked for a report of an incident that took place in a flat in the block that I live in. I expressly want that report, please, to have all the identification features blacked out. I want name blacked out, address blacked out, so that it is just a piece of discussion about an unnamed flat, unidentified flat. And it has some photographs of aspects of the flat, but no one in the outside world could figure out whose flat that was. He says, so if you take that document, which is the thing that I've just described that I'm asking for, it is totally anonymous, and it doesn't therefore trigger any of the personal data concerns under the Freedom of Information Act. No, says the upper tribunal, nice try, clever argument, but it is important to take a much more common sense, contextual approach to deciding whether or not something is personal data. Don't get too fixated, says Judge Jacobs, with fancy footwork on exactly how the identification might work and whether or not that identification seems to fit the statutory wording. Take a common sense approach. Of course you could figure out who the individual was. Anyone who lived in the block where this incident happened. They could all figure it out, because if they see this report on the internet, if that's where it ends up, they will know immediately whose flat is being referred to. So a common sense answer is obviously identifiable. Second of the framework questions that I set out, having looked at what is personal data that triggers the duties, who do those duties apply to? Answer, data controller, who, as we know, is someone who determines, either alone or with someone else, could be a joint data controller situation, someone who determines the purposes for which and manner in which personal data are or are to be processed. So purposes and manner are the things that need to be determined. Remember, of course, that it's not a simple, straightforward data controller or not. There will be margins where some clients will think, well, of course I'm a data controller, for example, for my own employees, but I don't think I'm a data controller for some of the other information that I harvest off the internet to pursue marketing activities. These sorts of at-the-margins questions were considered most forcefully in the Google Spain case, which Anya will talk a bit more about this afternoon. That case, of course, is famous for its right to be forgotten principle that it confirmed and injected into the legal bloodstream of the European Union. Famous for right to be forgotten, but importantly also considered this exact question: what is a data controller? Now, Google, perhaps understandably, up until that point, had been taking a view that was something like this. People write blogs, they write about other people, they post articles online. We, Google, have no influence and do not attempt to influence what is said in any of those pieces of content that float around on the internet. It is not our lookout, not our business. We do not determine the purposes and manner of the processing of the personal data that's contained in those articles. If you have a complaint about them, go and speak to the person who's actually hosting the website you're complaining about. Well, no, says the Court of Justice of the European Union, that's not the right way to look at it. Sure, Google, you're not controlling the purposes and manner of the articles themselves, but you're doing your own distinct additional type of processing. And what you're doing is using your algorithms and software to make available, upon request through typing into a search bar, a list, a generated list, an index of websites, and you help facilitate public access to the personal data. And that's a distinct act of processing. You're making available, you're facilitating, and your analysis and indexing. Those are your own distinct aspects of processing for which you, Google, are the data controller. You determine how they work, what their manner and purposes are. So Google is suddenly hit with Data Protection Act obligations to an extent it didn't think it had. The final point that's slightly more comforting in certain contexts to mention, just on the extent of data controllers, is that while Google Spain expressly takes a very wide approach, why, if in doubt, take the wide view on whether someone is a data controller, but it's not without limits. In a case now from 18 months or so ago in the Chancery Division, the Southern Pacific case I mentioned, the High Court confirms the view that when it comes to a company, company is likely to be a data controller, particularly if it is the registered data controller. Even if the directors, the individual directors of that company, are actually the minds who are steering what happens to the personal data, that does not mean that they are individually data controllers for that company's information. So despite the width that comes out of Google Spain, it's not right to extend data controller liability too widely in the context of company structures. Those then are, that's the how does Data Protection Act obligations arise and who do they bite? What then are the shape of these duties? Of course, the short answer is data controllers are required to comply with the data protection principles. Your clients internally or externally will probably be able to get their heads around, if not scrupulously apply, what most of those principles mean. I shouldn't disclose data outside of the EU without proper safeguards. I need to keep data safe. I understand those sorts of things, your client might say. I need to comply with subject access requests and so on. they might say, I also understand some of the other principles that are set out in Schedule 1 to the Act. I see that I need to make sure personal data is relevant and up-to-date, accurate, that it is not excessive, and so on. Those are cases, those are questions where Article 8 case law on privacy intrusions in the context of information are really informative. They help flesh out what those sorts of principles might mean under the Data Protection Act. What about the Data Protection Act principle that says do not process for a purpose that is incompatible with the one that you got the data for in the first place? What does incompatible mean? Does that mean different, or does it mean irreconcilable, or what? I don't have a slide on that because the answer is there isn't any law to help us on that. Strangely, one that isn't is a principle that deserves some scrutiny but isn't properly examined in the case law. Where the case law in the past year has really focused is on the first data protection principle, which says you have to process data fairly and lawfully, and you have to meet a Schedule 2 condition plus a Schedule 3 one if it's sensitive personal data. Now, the most common condition under Schedule 2 that arises to try and justify why you are processing data, Condition 6.1, and that is the one about a legitimate interest, your processing being necessary to a legitimate interest, except where it's unwarranted, where it causes unwarranted prejudice to the data subject. So that involves a balancing of interests. Clients might often say, what about fairness? Why is fairness different to that? Isn't fairness about balancing interests as well? So I've got condition 6.1, legitimate interests, and as opposed to unwarranted prejudice. I've got that on the one hand, but I've also got fairness on the other. What do they mean together? A couple of cases that have had a look at that in the past year or so. The AB and Chief Constable case that I mentioned. The argument there was, well, fairness must mean something different from those balancing of interests. Fairness means only fairness to the individual, never mind the public interest in what's done with the information. Just think about, were they treated fairly? Did they get what they ought to have expected from the processing of their personal data? And no, says the court, fairness is itself a wide concept that does mean taking into account the public interest in doing what you're doing with information as well. So quite a close alignment there between fairness and condition 6.1. The Surrey Heath Council case on the bottom of that slide is another FOI case, and there the upper tribunal takes the view, never mind this question of how is fairness different from condition 6.1. Doesn't really matter, says the upper tribunal. Condition 6.1 is just a specific instance of fairness. They mean roughly the same thing. One is just a bit more specifically worded than the other. The case of Surrey Heath Borough Council turns on the disclosure of personal data of minors, and the only point I draw out from that is that there was an argument to say that the public disclosure of information about children should never be justified. Or should only in extremely exceptional circumstances be a justifiable course of action for a data controller. I don't buy that, says the upper tribunal. That's too blanket a rule. We're talking here about FOI disclosures. Must be more fact-specific. And maturity and autonomy of these minors and their roles can matter more than their mere age. So beware of any blanket rule that says personal data about a minor means I should never disclose it to anyone. Chris mentioned this morning the data controller's duties under Condition 6.1, the question that I've been looking at, the Schedule 2 condition, Condition 6.1. How do you actually apply it? It contains various components. How do you actually apply that test to make sure you get it right? Goldsmith in the upper tribunal is the FOI case that sets out on a proposition-by-proposition basis what I've listed as items 1 to 7. There was an eighth one about some of the other case law, but in practical terms, this is what the upper tribunal tells you you need to follow by way of a framework. I'm not going to talk through all of these questions now. I set them out there for you, relevant for you to have a think about when assisting clients with whether or not they come within Condition 6.1 territory. What I flag up straight away, though, is right down the bottom, questions 6 and 7, you will see a distinction being drawn that does come through in some of the case law a distinction between what we could think of as vanilla personal data, personal data that doesn't actually have very much of a privacy bearing at all. That on the one hand, and Article 8, privacy-related personal data on the other. So it's relevant to ask yourself and have your clients ask, help them with the question, we're looking at some personal data here, do we think the individual's Article 8 rights would be engaged with respect to that information or not? If the answer is no, then you have an easier job in justifying the processing that you are contemplating. If the answer is yes, then you need to make sure you go on and ask, well, what about any harm that could come to their interests as a result of this disclosure? An example might be that you take away this pack with you, this slide pack, and at the front contains personal data of all of the speakers today, including Chris Knight. It's the sort of thing you might take back to the office. It might be shown to some of your colleagues. You might speak to some of your colleagues about it. That involves an extent of processing of personal data. It's our names. It contains some biographical information about us. But it is vanilla personal data in the sense that it is provided to you at the front of a document that you are handed when you come here. None of us are claiming that our Article 8 rights are engaged by the handing to you of information which we voluntarily provide to you. Last bit of data controller's duties, a specific instance, is of course subject access requests. Now, these are the bane of many data controllers' lives, and a number of questions are commonly asked by clients. One of them is, you know, what is the scope of personal data that would be within this request? And I've talked a bit about that this morning. Other questions are, can I say no because this would be really burdensome to comply with? Checkered answer on that, and it depends who you ask, and it depends how you read various documents. Unhelpfully, not very much by way of guidance from the courts in the last year. So there is no clarity yet on the extent to which data controllers can apply a it's too burdensome line to refuse a subject access request. What about where you can spot quite obviously that the purpose behind the subject access request is nothing to do with checking the accuracy of your data, safeguarding your privacy, but it's really the individual wanting to use this as a precursor to litigation, a fishing expedition as it tends to be called. Can you say no on that basis? Well, the courts shed light on this question to the extent that they consider their own discretion. There is a distinction, of course, between what you are allowed to do as a data controller. You cannot reach for an exemption under the Act that says, ah, I spot your purpose, and therefore I say no. No such exemption available to you as a data controller. But courts, under Section 7.9, if they're asked to order disclosure in response to a subject access request, they have a very wide discretion, and they are allowed to consider exactly these sorts of questions, including proportionality of ordering compliance, so burden certainly comes in at that stage, and the purpose behind the request in the first place. The High Court has most recently had a look at that in the case of Kololo. That's on the bottom of that slide. Factual context there was, requester said, yes, I'm making this subject access request to help with my litigation. As it happens, my litigation is that I'm on death row in Kenya, and I'm trying to appeal that. So it's not your usual sort of, hello, I propose to sue you, or at least not overtly that. But nonetheless, the purpose was driven by a distinct piece of litigation. Did that count as an improper use of subject access rights such that it could be dismissed as an abusive process? The court could have grappled with this as a broad-ranging principled issue and given lots of guidance on what you as data controllers should do and what the court should do with motives. It ducked that, really, and only answered the question in this way. I see, says Mr. Justice Dingemans, as I see it, this individual clearly has as their main purpose assistance with their litigation. But they will also, I think, want to check whether any of the information they might get from the police is accurate. And if there are any inaccuracies, they might want to challenge that and complain about them. One of the things they probably want to do. Secondary, very minor purpose, but it's a purpose behind their request. And once it's a purpose behind their request, he says, I'm not going to dismiss this as an abusive process. There has been case law in the past at county court level considering Should it be the dominant? What if it's the dominant purpose? Or how, to what extent does a DPA purpose have to weigh in the mix? Answer in the Kololo case appears to be, well, there just has to be one aspect of a Data Protection Act type purpose involved as part of the motivation for the request. If so, can't knock it back on the grounds that it is pursued improperly. A final topic, what happens if our data controller gets things wrong? Framework of answers, the ICO, of course, has its powers under Section 40 to order enforcement with the Data Protection Act. It has its softer power under Section 42 to issue an assessment or an opinion of whether or not there has been compliance. And, of course, it has the much more hardcore power to issue monetary penalties under Section 55A. Not very much by way of litigation on the monetary penalty side over the past year. The points that I draw out come most interestingly through the Privacy and Electronic Communications Regulations 2003, monetary penalties issued under that regime rather than under the Data Protection Act itself. Niebel, the Tetris Telecoms appeal that went to the upper tribunal, saw the spam texter, if I can call him that, and I suppose I can because he was my client and I helped him do this, saw him knock back that penalty and get it overturned. That resulted in a change to the law in as far as electronic communications goes. They dropped the difficult limb that an offending text message, marketing material, needs to be the kind of thing that would cause substantial damage or substantial distress. The law has now been changed so that condition no longer needs to be satisfied in order for there to be a monetary penalty in the context of electronic communications. The case that has picked apart the various limbs of the monetary penalty regime in most detail is the Amber fabrications case that I put on the bottom of that slide. Lots of interesting principles that come out of that case. It is a first-tier case, so it doesn't determine the shape of the monetary penalty regime, but it is a much more ICO-friendly approach taken by the tribunal in that case. Again, a case involving unsolicited marketing communications. Points that your clients might want to consider from that case include, if you bombard lots and lots of people with messages, all the more likely that you're going to cause someone within that huge range of affected parties some sort of damage or distress. And that might apply in the ordinary Data Protection Act context as well. If you lose a spreadsheet containing 100,000 names, you are much more likely to find that someone, even some one individual within that spreadsheet, is caused substantial damage or substantial distress. So volume matters. The greater the extent of your breach, the more likely you are to get stung. The other avenue for what happens if things go wrong from the Data Protection Act's point of view, we talked a bit about the ICO. That's one route for complaints to be pursued. The courts are, of course, the other route. Courts have powers under Section 10 and 14, but really this, what I want to focus on now is some concluding thoughts on Section 13, and that is the provision for monetary compensation to be awarded by a court for a breach of the Data Protection Act. The Halliday case from a couple of years ago, Court of Appeal case, that draws out a couple of points that still apply. One is that there must actually be the requisite causal link between what the individual says they've suffered and the Data Protection Act breach they've established. Their factual context can get very convoluted. There are cases where individuals say, you disclosed something, and somebody then sued me, improperly, but they sued me on the basis of that disclosure, and I had to fend off that piece of vexatious litigation. Or I have been snubbed unfairly for a promotion at work based on this particular disclosure. Now, does that count as a consequence that that sits at the door of the data controller for improperly disclosing a piece of information? They might say, I'm responsible for my breach, yes, but I'm not responsible for the decisions that other people take unreasonably on that basis. Courts haven't really helped us engage with that yet. This is part of the open landscape of the DPA that courts will at some point need to grapple with. Halliday, of course, also notable because it only awarded £750 worth of compensation to a man who had suffered really quite considerable inconvenience. The next case I mentioned more recently, AB and the MOJ, series of subject access requests. Individual is messed around. he does suffer quite a lot of hassle and distress. He gets 2,250, so award seems to be creeping up. The CR19 case, third on our slide, that's a Northern Irish case. 20,000 was the award in that case, and that was not a DPA award. That was an award for negligence arising out of the loss of personal information. Now, that sits directly alongside the Data Protection Act claim in that case. The 20,000, two points I make out of it. One is that evidence really counts. £2,250 in our AB case, £750 in Mr. Halliday's case. But the courts there said, look, we're struggling to grapple with the evidence on how there was actual harm here. And in the CR19 case, there was a much more neatly put together evidential case that helped the court with the damage or distress. And the second point to come from the CR19 case is that, in my view, there is an increasing trend towards taking the request of the individual situation and saying, I'm not just complaining and asking for money because I say in my letter of complaint that I'm distressed. I've actually gone and obtained medical certification of the harm that this has caused me. And I claim, effectively, a personal injury loss. And the stakes, if that is what is involved, turning a Data Protection Act claim or fusing a Data Protection Act claim with a personal injury claim, that transforms the outlook in terms of likely damages quite markedly. It's an early stage development, but I know there are more cases coming through that fuse DPA breaches and personal injury. So that's something to look out for in the next year or so. And lastly, as is the slide I mentioned on that, the last case I mentioned on my slide, Biddle Hall and others against Google. Again, Anya will talk about this case this afternoon. A number of interesting points come out of it, even aside from the sexy media context and into our nuts and bolts, you know, the Data Protection Act in its everyday overalls context. We will get really important, interesting points from that judgment. They include the scope of personal data in the online environment, an IP address, for example. Under what circumstances is an IP address personal data? We'll get some help with that. And we will also get crucial help with how to interpret this compensation provision under Section 13 of the Data Protection Act. So watch that space. Bear in mind trends towards better evidenced claimant cases on damage and distress and the fusion of data protection breaches and personal injury. I think we're going to see a lot more and a lot more muscular litigation on these sorts of breaches over the next few years. Thanks very much.